You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Universal basic income is an idea that's long been floated in academic circles, especially around Silicon Valley.
My flagship proposal is the freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for every American adult starting at age 18.
While tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang campaigned for president on the idea of a universal basic income for all Americans, the city of Stockton, California, was already engaged in a UBI pilot program called SEED. 125 residents have been receiving $500 every month for the past year. Some of the people who've participated say it's completely changed their lives.
It gave me that clear head and that clear mind to where I was able to think again and not be so stressed out and not have all that weight on my shoulders.
Tomas Vargas was a young father juggling multiple low-paying jobs. Poverty fueled violence and trauma in his community, and the stress was taking a toll on him.
I actually went to 13 funerals in 1 year. So I did one every month, and I got one extra at the end of the year. I actually didn't want to be around anymore. I was really struggling just to find myself again.
Vargas thought the SEED program was some kind of joke at first. But when the money actually started coming in, he and his wife invested it immediately. They improved Vargas's credit and helped pay for his sister's college tuition. Today, Vargas has a full-time job he's passionate about, something he says he never would have gotten without the program. And when COVID-19 prompted a nationwide lockdown, SEED money helped Vargas get through a brief period of unemployment.
I'm hearing stories like the stories of Tomas, or one lady talks about how the $500 a month was enough for her to smile again because she had needed dentures for several years and could never afford them. And with her first SEED check, she was able to buy dentures and have the dignity of being able to smile.
That's Michael Tubbs. He's mayor of Stockton, and the SEED program is one of his passion projects. Now he's leading a coalition of 11 mayors from Los Angeles to Philadelphia, advocating for a large-scale universal basic income. I spoke with Mayor Tubbs via video conference. You might hear some occasional interference with the internet connection. Mayor, welcome to World Affairs.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Abhijit Banerjee joins us too. He, along with his wife Esther Duflo and their colleague Michael Kramer, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2019 for their use of data to identify causes of poverty and to evaluate the effectiveness of poverty alleviation programs. Professor Banerjee teaches economics at MIT. He grew up in India, which is experiencing one of the worst COVID outbreaks on the planet. It's number two in the world, with 4.4 million known infections and more than 75,000 deaths at the time of this recording. Professor Banerjee, you've been recommending an immediate implementation of an emergency cash transfer program of about $17 a month for every Indian citizen. What would that accomplish?
Keep people from starving. I mean, there's a food support program. You can get free food, but only if you happen to be in that area. If you happen to be somewhere else, tough luck. So it's like there's a bunch of people, millions of people who are falling through the net, and this is one way to just give them something to hold on to.
There are millions and millions of Indians working in the informal sector, sort of catch-as-catch-can kind of jobs. There are millions and millions more working on the land. Who's been affected and how by the arrival of infection limitation measures, the kind of lockdown that India has done?
Well, I think the biggest single group are just migrants. There's now people think there is at least 30 million migrants, people who are residents of some village, but who happen to be in a city working, typically, as you say, in some informal job, often on a construction site or, you know, cleaning a truck, bussing tables in a restaurant. And these people are not residents of the cities where they are. They're often 1,000 miles away. And when the lockdown happened, they were stranded. Basically, their jobs immediately shut down. The construction was stopped. And what happened after that was these people just had nothing to do. And in fact, nowhere to stay because they usually don't, in order to save money, they don't rent a space. What they do is they sleep on the construction site or under the truck or in the restaurant. So they had no place to stay and no money. And you saw just millions of Indians trying to walk their way 1,000 miles in May heat, May Indian heat, which is, you know, often 40 degrees centigrade, over 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and walking their way home because life was just not possible elsewhere. So that's the single worst affected group are clearly the migrants.
Mayor Tubbs, Stockton, California is a pretty different place from India. How's the pandemic hit the residents of your city?
COVID-19 has hit everyone in the city, but particularly those who are already one paycheck away or who are already, quote unquote, marginalized. So we've seen an outbreak in COVID-19 cases, particularly in our farm worker and migrant communities, the majority of whom are working minimum wage or just above minimum wage. So we know a lot of people are stressed and anxious about kind of paying bills and paying rent and paying mortgage. We know many of our small businesses, particularly restaurants, are holding on by a thread. And that's why as a city, we've done everything we can from just giving grants to small businesses and nonprofits to ensure that during this time, people have the money needed to build the resilience to persist during a pandemic such as this one.
How does the SEED program work? What's it look like if you're a recipient of SEED in Stockton?
Essentially, every month, recipients, 125 of them, are given $500 a month on the debit card, no strings attached. And then throughout the month, both those who are in the program and those who are in the control group are given surveys or have a conversation just so our research and evaluation team has an understanding about sort of beyond the data, what's the story behind how the money is being spent. And because we've saw so many people struggle with gaining unemployment insurance, despite the fact they're paying into it, we saw so many people who are saying they were not going to take time off of work, even with symptoms, because they needed money. We decided to extend the program to January because we've heard from folks in the program that the $500 was a literal lifeline. It was the difference between sheltering in place and going to work. It was the difference between taking time off to get tested or not getting tested. And it's the difference between sort of hunger while waiting for unemployment insurance after being laid off and having the ability to actually pay for food for yourself and your families. The data tells us that for the vast majority of expenditures go right back to the local economy. Folks are spending upwards of 50% of their income on food and on utilities, and they're not getting their car fixed. So I think for me, the biggest takeaway has been just how not just poor folks or people in poverty, but a lot of people in our society are one accident, one pandemic, one layoff, one sickness away from financial ruin, which has economic and moral consequences for the entire society. So it's been inspiring, but also heartbreaking to see how something as small as $500 a month has made a world of difference in terms of the quality of lives and the lack of anxiety and the dignity people are able to live with.
Well, we're lucky enough to have a Nobel Prize economist with us who was recognized in the citation for the use of data and evidence. Professor, what kind of evidence do you have to show the world that UBI might work in a case like this?
We have evidence from Kenya, where we've been carrying out a pretty large randomized control trial, kind of along the line that the mayor described, but with 20,000 people. We actually have some results on what happened during the pandemic, and we see that has big effects on their ability to avoid just plain starvation or, you know, going down to one meal a day or just being extremely kind of unhappy. So it has clear consequences in a pandemic like this one. I had to say that if I had to think of how I would deal with a pandemic, you may want to target the money exactly because, you know, some jobs are lost and others are not, and if money is scarce, it's not clear that the pandemic is the best time to start universal basic income. It's more something I would think is valuable for not a crisis, but for normal life. The fact that it's universal and that it's income is important. It's not welfare, it's income. And I think that just the mindset of that is what I think the West will need to think about at the end of this pandemic, whether we want a world where everybody feels that they are entitled to some minimum income.
You talk about changing a mindset about what UBI is, not welfare, but income. But again and again in these conversations around the world, there's a kind of puritanical attitude toward the money. Well, if we give it to poor people, they'll spend it on beer and cigarettes. They'll spend it on less productive pursuits. We can't trust poor people with money. It's one of the reasons why they're poor in the first place. Do we have to build in some proof, not only for policymakers, but for a wider community that has to, in effect, subsidize these payments, that this is good for them, good for everybody, and actually has some economic traction in it?
There's no evidence that really people stop working when you give them easy money. So there's a World Bank kind of meta-analysis for many, many, many countries showing that basically there's no evidence that giving people some extra income makes them go out and buy alcohol or, you know, what the study calls temptation goods, which could be cigarettes, alcohol, you know, maybe other things. But it's just no evidence for it. I think there is, this is Victorian propaganda. I think the Victorian state was very careful with its money, let's say. And one way it defended that is by creating this myth of the lazy and feckless poor, who, if you give them the money, they'll drink it up and stop working. And it's really important and really sad because it isn't supported by really any data that I know of.
Mayor Tubbs, the United States, even though Queen Victoria has been dead for an awful long time, is one of the capitals worldwide of that kind of attitude, both toward poor people and the idea of helping poor people financially. Was there a pushback? Was there contrary opinion, even among citizens of Stockton, who can see the effects of economic hard times, that, hey, what are you giving people money for?
Absolutely. And I think in the American context, it's also racialized in that we have had for the past hundreds of years the depictions of people of color, particularly Black people, as poor, as lazy, as not industrious, as taking from the state. We have whole political campaigns that ran against this idea that some people just take and some people give. So when we launched the basic income pilot in Stockton, we, given the diversity of the city, we definitely had to contend with this othering, this idea that I know how to use money, but these people don't, despite the fact this is before anyone was selected. So by going headfirst in that conversation and making sure this conversation around a basic income or a guaranteed income is having in concert with other conversations about othering and race and difference, we've been able to get to a point where we recognize the inherent dignity in all people. And as the professor said, the fact that the evidence suggests that folks aren't spending money on drugs and alcohol and on vices. And I would argue, particularly in America, we have a history of giving people money and giving people things. It just happens to be people who already have. I mean, most of our COVID-19 response has been giving money to folks who have money or to businesses and to corporations. So I think part of what we're trying to solve for in the American context in Stockton is this idea that you can trust poor people with money like you trust rich people with money.
Professor, earlier you said that a pandemic is not the best time for introducing a program like this, yet it would seem to me that India, facing the particular problems it does right now, that the pandemic might be laying the groundwork for a conversation about UBI that you wouldn't be able to have otherwise.
I hope people do start to recognize that shocks like the pandemic, one thing they do is they show us that even though I am, you know, I think of myself as being securely employed and therefore not needing help, you know, if there's a pandemic and the great restaurant where I'm actually the, you know, the wine steward shuts down, then I might still be out of a job. So even skilled people lost their jobs. And that's one of the great arguments for having a kind of an open pipeline to say that, look, you may be very secure today, but God knows when you will lose the job. And if you have to then, you know, send in large volumes of papers to demonstrate that you really need the money, maybe that's going to be too late. You'll already be starving, or your children would have been taken out of school. So it's something that I think is very appealing, exactly on those grounds, that it's automatic. Everybody has something, irrespective of whether they have the job or not. I think that automaticity is appealing, especially in a world which is unpredictable and where, you know, many people who don't think of themselves as being vulnerable turn out to be vulnerable.
Well, let me close with both of you gentlemen by getting some insight into where the money would come from and whether you feel like you've got a shot toward making a plausible case for something like universal basic income, whether you have an argument that you're ready to give that this is worth it to a society that's at least willing to listen to your suggestion that we embark on it. Mayor, where does the money come from?
That's one of the most frequently asked questions. So right now in the United States Congress, there's bills to reverse the 2017 tax cuts. And doing so would provide $500 a month to every family making $125,000 or less, which isn't necessarily a universal basic income, but it's a guaranteed income. It's an important and great first step that we know will at least help everyone who absolutely needs it. So there's also conversations about if cannabis was legalized and using a tax on that. There's proposals from folks like Chris Hughes for small Wall Street transactions, tax on certain types of derivative trading that would raise the revenue to provide a guaranteed income to people making 50K or less. There's conversations nationwide about data and about the value our data creates and how that data could be analogous to what Alaska does with their Alaska Permanent Fund as a means for providing sort of a guaranteed income to people. So I think that the imagination around how to pay for it is a conversation that'd be great to have. But I think the first thing we have to do is marshal the will to say, this is something that we have to pay for. Part of it is also realizing that we are paying, that poverty and economic insecurity is extremely expensive for everyone. The amount of homelessness we see in our cities, the amount that's spent on emergency healthcare visits, the lack of productivity, the amount we pay for law enforcement, like all those things are consequences of not having an income floor and of economic insecurity. So I think I would reframe the question as to, can we continue to afford not paying for something like this? Because we're paying in all type of collateral consequences and ways.
Professor, would this have to, in India, have a, by definition, a different face from the one it has in the United States, from the one it has in Kenya? Is this highly conditioned, once you figure out how you're going to pay for it, by what country you're talking about?
I think the general truth is that there's a lot of piecemeal social welfare programs in most countries. A little bit of subsidy for this, a little bit of subsidy for that. I think the way to think about it is partly that, you know, you want to replace all of those piecemeal things which go to some people and not others by a single payment and try to move in that direction. Now, that's politically even more contentious because it involves taking something away from people. But I think in the medium run, what we might hope for is that as these poorer countries grow, they're going to be able to create some fiscal space. And if that space is no longer allocated into the existing programs, you know, if the current subsidies are kept, but they're capped where they are, then as the economies grow, there'll be more and more slack. And maybe that can be used for universal basic income. Seems to me that that's the best chance it has.
Abhijit Banerjee is an economist working at MIT. He's a co-winner with his wife Esther Duflo and their colleague Michael Kramer of the Nobel Prize in Economics for 2019. Professor, thanks for joining us on World Affairs.
Thank you. That was great.
And Michael Tubbs is the mayor of Stockton, California. Mayor, good luck. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We just heard how UBI can help lift people out of poverty, But the whole point of universal basic income is that everyone gets it, the rich, the poor, and everybody in between. Producer Teresa Katsourilas takes us to Alaska, where every resident gets cash from the government. And she brings us a story about what can go wrong.
Rasha McChesney reports for Alaska Public Media's Energy Desk in Juneau. She's also the host of Paying Dividends, which she describes as a very nerdy podcast about a unique cash payment system in Alaska. It's called the Permanent Fund Dividend, and it's better known as the PFD.
When I'm talking to people about the PFD who don't live here, I generally, like, the first thing that I bring up is the Simpsons episode where they drive all the way to Alaska and they cross over the border.
Welcome to Alaska. Here's $1,000. Well, it's about time.
And I think it's like the border guard is like, welcome to Alaska. Here's $1,000. And Homer's just like, woohoo.
Why? We pay every resident $1,000 to allow the oil companies to ravage our state's natural beauty.
I'm home.
And I think that's sort of, if you live outside of the state, that's kind of just what it looks like. It's just sort of checks for just living in Alaska and being an Alaskan. I think what's lost and what I try to sort of personally explain to people is, like, that's not just free money for being here.
For all you non-Alaskans out there, here's a little PFD 101. When the oil boom came to Alaska in the late 1960s, the state's government wanted to make sure that it actually benefited Alaskans. So they started putting oil revenue aside in a big state fund and investing it. Then political leaders wanted to make sure that everyone in Alaska benefited from that investment. So in the 1980s, they started distributing that cash to residents.
That's your share of the oil wealth.
And that is the PFD. Every year, every Alaskan gets a check from their state government. Everyone gets the same amount, regardless of how much money they make. And just to be clear, Rasha says the PFD is not technically a universal basic income program.
It's missing some key pieces. The basic in universal basic income implies that the benefit that you're getting is going to be sort of large enough to create some kind of substantial barrier to abject poverty. And in reality, Alaska's permanent fund dividend doesn't do that. It's a once-a-year payment, and it's not that large.
We're talking a few thousand dollars tops here. The amount of money Alaskans get also varies year to year, based on how well the oil market's doing. But while the PFD is not actually universal basic income, Rasha says it's the closest a U.S. state has ever gotten to implementing one.
Alaskans do get this check universally. Every man, woman, and child are eligible, regardless of how much money they already have. And that's different from sort of experiments that have happened in other states where they've sort of targeted specific income groups.
And it's been around a long time. Alaska has been running this program for about 30 years.
I guess you could call it one of the sort of longest running experiments in something like a universal basic income. So I do think that there's a lot to learn in terms of what you can do for particular populations of people when they do get just even this small amount of money from the government, and how much they've come to rely on it, and how much it sort of factors into how people are able to maintain, you know, their lifestyles.
So Alaska's 30 years into this kind of sort of experiment with universal basic income. What can we learn? Well, the first thing you need to know is that the PFD is really popular. It has bipartisan support. Everyone gets something out of it. Do you remember the first time you got the PFD?
I do, actually.
Rasha had just moved to Alaska.
It was like a $2,000 check, which was a really nice bonus. My sister had gotten sick, and I remember needing to buy this, like, really expensive plane ticket from, you know, Anchorage, Alaska to Houston, Texas. And it was this really nice, just sort of weird way to feel supported by the government of the state that I lived in, that I could afford this plane ticket.
But Rasha says Alaskans spend this money really differently, depending on where they live and how rich they are.
You know, this is sort of tricky. It gets into this idea of, like, two Alaskas, right?
Alaska's still a pretty unsettled place. And one of the biggest divides there is between the part of the state that has roads and the part of the state that doesn't. The communities on the road system are the ones you've probably heard of. Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks. They have Walmarts and shopping malls. Most towns are majority white. And while a lot of people are struggling financially, a lot of people aren't.
So for some of us, it's a bonus. It's a happy bonus for the year, and we can use it to buy, you know, I don't know, new clothes, put it as a down payment on a car.
Then you have the Alaska that's off the road system. You can only get to these communities by plane. A high percentage of the state's Alaska Native community lives there, and many people still subsistence hunt and fish. Some of these towns are among the poorest in the United States.
There are large swaths of this state that rely on the PFD funding that they themselves and their families bring in for food, subsistence gathering purposes, or heating fuel for the winter. These sort of key things that I think the rest of us kind of take for granted. It has lifted a large percentage of Alaskans. It has boosted their income and has allowed them, you know, maybe to avoid poverty, or at least the sort of worst kinds of poverty. So it's really important to a huge segment of our state.
The second thing you need to know is that the PFD is at the center of a lot of problems right now. Because a lot of Alaskans love the PFD, but a lot of those same Alaskans want the rest of the government to be as small as possible. Remember Sarah Palin?
Government is too big.
Alaska doesn't have an income or sales tax. Instead, the budget is all tangled up in how well the oil market's doing. And as you've probably noticed, oil has not been doing that well. Rasha says the trouble really started in 2015. The PFD used to come out of this fund that politicians weren't allowed to touch. They couldn't use the money for anything else. But Alaska was in the middle of a budget crisis, so the governor changed that.
PFD funds now are being used to partially fund state government.
The governor also capped the PFD checks. The amount of money used to rise and fall with the state's oil revenue. Now it wouldn't go above $1,000. People were not happy.
A lot of Alaskans, you know, depend on those checks. And even if they don't depend on those checks, they depend on the sort of owner state mentality. That's their money. And so our current governor, Governor Dunleavy, who I guess you could probably call him a far-right Republican, ran on this platform of repaying Alaskans for the years that their PFD checks were capped.
I'm excited about the opportunity. Some people have said to me, what are you, crazy running for governor given this climate? This is the time to do it. This is the time to change things and turn things around right now.
And it was just nearly $7,000 checks that he was promising to Alaskans. And he won by a landslide.
So in 2019, Governor Dunleavy took office and was stuck with the same budget crisis the previous governor had been dealing with.
How do we balance the budget? And Governor Dunleavy came in on this promise of sort of sending $7,000 checks to everyone. And he also doesn't want any new taxes. So he ended up proposing a budget that really cut super deeply into state services.
At one point, these budget cuts came out to around $440 million.
One thing that I was really struck by was, I think it was something like a $70 million cut to the state's university system.
It actually went up to over $100 million. He proposed cutting 41% of the University of Alaska's entire budget.
I tend to think of education as sort of sacrosanct, and it wasn't. and I think a lot of people sort of felt that way about cuts to school systems as well in the state, K through 12 education. It's like, if we've reached this level as a state where we can't even fund schools, how are we going to, who's going to want to live here?
To make matters worse, a lot of these cuts disproportionately hurt one of those two Alaskas we talked about earlier, the one off the road system.
One thing that the discussion leaves out when we talk about cutting services is that rural Alaska is a completely different world. And I think it's important to acknowledge that I'm saying rural Alaska, but what I actually mean is that there's a disproportionate impact on Alaska Native people who live in rural Alaska and are using these services and don't have access to the conveniences that we have on the road system.
In the course of this budget fight, Dunleavy vetoed almost $100 million from Medicaid. He eliminated all of the state's Head Start funding. And he cut millions of dollars from a training program for police officers in Native communities, even though Alaska Native communities are desperate for officers. As it stands now, one in every three Alaska Native villages don't have any local law enforcement at all.
The blowback was just enormous.
Governor Dunleavy is being threatened with a recall campaign. He walked back a lot of his cuts last December, but he still cut the state's ferry system and education. Then, this past April, he proposed $210 million in new cuts. After a year and a half of political squabbling, the state legislature is still fighting over what to cut and how much. In the meantime, Rasha says,
we haven't gotten our $7,000 checks. Like, that hasn't happened. That hasn't materialized. This state has a serious budgeting problem. We are facing dwindling oil revenue, and that's not going to bump up anytime soon. So our major funding source is leaving us.
A new tax on the oil industry will be on the state ballot this November. But beyond that, Alaska isn't really debating raising taxes. So the government is using the same pot of oil money to fund both the PFD and day-to-day operations of the state's government. And that pot's not getting any bigger.
Regardless of Governor Dunleavy's intentions, you know, what's actually happening is that the dividend is being pitted against state services.
And if they're competing against each other, well, some Alaskans have picked a side. During the state budget fights last year, two powerful Republicans in the legislature voted against giving Alaskans that big, nearly $7,000 PFD check. They thought the cuts to social services Dunleavy was proposing to pay for it would cause too much damage. Fast forward to today, and Alaska just had a primary election. Those two politicians were voted out.
The PFD is extremely political. There's no way to think of it in any other way. I mean, there are so many other things at play, but at least some cases Alaskans are saying, or appear to be saying, you know, you're voting against larger PFDs and that's going to affect you at the ballot box.
And that might be one of the most important lessons from Alaska's experiment with universal basic income. When a cash program that everyone benefits from is pitted against social programs the poor benefit from, even if the poor really, really need them? Well, so far, looks like the cash program wins.
You've been listening to World Affairs. That was Teresa Katsourilis reporting on Alaska's experiment with universal basic income. Earlier, Ray Suarez spoke with economists Abhijit Banerjee and Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider supporting the program you value by making a donation at worldaffairs.org. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from First Republic and Chevron. This episode was produced by Teresa Katsourilis, Jared Sport, and Joanne Jennings. Hannah Harasaki, Catherine Putz, and Tatum Sanderback provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Philip Young. Thank you for listening.